Hey everyone, I'm your host, Patrick Brown. Here at Crown & Crozier, we have a recurring series in which we examine the extraordinary lives and witness of saintly rulers, those who held state office, whether as a monarch or an elected official, and who pursued holiness and sanctification through the fulfillment of their responsibilities in that office. In this episode, with the centennial anniversary of his death falling on April 1st, 2022, we shine the spotlight on Blessed Karl of Austria, also known as Charles I. Joining us to talk about Blessed Karl's legacy, as well as its relevance in the present context of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, is Father Raymond D'Souza. Father Raymond is one of North America's most well-known Catholic commentators, with columns regularly appearing in the National Post and National Catholic Register. He also serves as a parish priest in the Archdiocese of Kingston, Ontario. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe, follow us on Facebook or Twitter, or leave us a rating wherever you get your podcast. And please enjoy this installment of the podcast on church, state, and faithful citizenship.
There are two swords, and the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant, at God's first.
It's a great joy to welcome our guest, Father Raymond D'Souza. Father Raymond, thanks so much for being here on Crown & Crozier.
Most welcome, Patrick. Thank you.
First off, welcome to the neighborhood. I understand you've recently relocated parishes to Kentville, and you're out here in Eastern Ontario on the doorstep of the national capital. No better place to be, as far as I'm concerned. The very best of small town and country living, close to the capital, but not too close, thankfully.
Okay, for a guest, I'm newly transferred to Kempville Holy Cross Parish. I was quite happy where I was, actually, at Wolf Island and Kingston at the university. But we'll see if what you say is true, that this is better.
Well, we're happy to have you. I will be the first to admit, before we hatch the idea of focusing on Blessed Karl of Austria for this interview, I pretty much had no idea who the guy was or what was significant about him. So I'm really looking forward to diving more into his life and his legacy and using this conversation as an opportunity to help celebrate the occasion of the 100-year anniversary of his death on April 1st, 2022. So to help us get better acquainted with the man, Father, perhaps you can tell us, what do Catholics have to learn from Blessed Karl, and why should we take note of his place in the history of the church and the history of the world?
He's a saint, or a blessed anyway, so that recommends him at least at a very, I think, lofty level. But Blessed Karl of Austria was the last Habsburg emperor. Why would this be of interest to Catholics? Well, the Habsburg Empire, which lasted for many centuries and included many of the Central European lands, it was sometimes, people may have heard of it if they don't know the family dynasty. Habsburg is the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or the dual monarchy of Austria and Hungary. So those countries right in the center of Europe, Vienna, capital of Austria, and Budapest. And it was a Catholic empire. It was a Catholic monarchy that lasted for a very long time. I mean, history is more complicated, but you know, they would trace their roots right back to the Holy Roman Empire in the time of Charlemagne, you know, which is the year 800 he was crowned. But leave that aside, they were a Catholic empire. Now, Catholic kings are not immune from original sin, and so the Habsburg family had a lot of, over the centuries, virtuous and not so virtuous characters, good relations with the church and aggressive relations against the church. But he was the heir to that throne. At the end of the Second World War, the First World War, 1918, the Habsburg Empire was dissolved. The monarchy fell in Austria-Hungary. The monarchy fell in Russia, the Kaiser. The monarchy fell, I said Russia, I meant Germany. And the monarchy fell, the Tsar, in Russia. And so Karl lost his empire, and he died in 1922. He was born in 1887, so you know, he was in his late 30s when he died. He'd been married, he had 8 children, He was an extraordinarily holy man in his private practice of the faith. And as emperor, he became emperor in 1916, right during the First World War, and he tried his best to achieve peace in a war that seemed to have mysterious beginnings and impossible end. So why is he important today? One is that it proves that you can be very powerful and holy. In his own family, he had many examples of people who were powerful but didn't use their power for holiness. But it is possible to have high office. In a certain sense, you could say, you know, to be the emperor of the Habsburg Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, it's about the highest office you can get. And he did it. And he did it in a way that's very admirable. He's also close to our time, right? He died 1922. He also experienced loss. I mean, he lost his throne. He was forced out of his country into exile. He lost the vocation which he thought he was called to, namely to be the emperor. He even lost the esteem of his countrymen, and he died in a kind of ignominious exile. So he experienced also serious setbacks. And today, you know, with this war that's going on between Russia's invasion of Ukraine, you know, Ukraine, he spent time in what is now Ukraine. The borders were shifting around there. Some of what's going on today, his life could shed light on. For those people who may not know too much about the different territories, when Karl became emperor in 1916, Krakow was part of his territory. Mm. Karol Wojtyła, John Paul II's father, served in the Habsburg Empire. Charles was his emperor at one point. And in 2004, John Paul beatified him in October. He was amongst the last group of blesseds that John Paul beatified. And on that occasion, he remarked that he had beatified his own father's, was in the armed forces, his own father's commander in chief, as it were. They don't use that term. But so there are some interesting connections there. And then today, people are beginning to think about relationships between church and state. Obviously, your podcast is called The Crown and Crozier, so it's a version of altar and throne. Well, Charles lived that, and his family lived it for many centuries. And so for people who are interested in those kinds of questions, Charles, Blessed Karl of Austria, has something to offer.
In terms of his beatification, was there a singular event or a singular motivating factor that informed or influenced the beatification, or was it a recognition of a pattern of holiness and piety in his life, or perhaps a combination of the two?
Yeah, actually, I think that, you know, you can imagine in history a beloved king with a reputation for holiness. Many people are interested in his cause. Charles is the opposite. I mean, Charles, the empire he ruled over was dissolved. In Austria, they said the Habsburgs, the direct descendants, could never return to the country. They didn't want this monarchy coming back. He tried to reclaim the crown in Hungary, and that was rebuffed. So he didn't actually have a big legion of fans who were going to say, we should get him beatified. Quite the contrary, in Austria and Hungary, there was a desire to move away from the Habsburg period, and not to, if you want to say, glorify the monarchy. His eldest son, Otto von Habsburg, was a very prominent European public figure. So the family had not disappeared. So actually, it's kind of against, if you want to say, secular historical reasons. So it really was the example of his holiness, is that he had an extraordinarily visible piety and holiness. So the reason was his holiness. Now, it is to be noted that he was an emperor, so he had that fame. And if you ask why are certain people beatified and other people's are not, it, you know, being well known is a sort of a criteria for any kind of cult to grow up. So obviously the fact that he was an emperor drew attention to him.
And from what I understand, he had a unique position and perspective among the major leaders around the time of World War I. He was one of the only or one of the few voices that was advocating for peace. he came to the throne in 1916 and he saw all the carnage going on and just wanted it to stop. Is it fair to say that he was one of the few, if not only major leaders, aggressively pushing for peace?
It is fair to say that. You have to give a little bit of context to the other leaders. So the history of his immediate family was complicated. The emperor in the 19th century, for over 60 years, the emperor was Franz Josef, the longest serving emperor of that dynasty. And Franz Josef, he had a very, very chaotic family life. And his crown prince committed suicide, his son, in the company of his mistress, which was scandalous. And so then the throne was going to pass to his nephew. And that was he was the heir to the throne. His name was Franz Ferdinand. Franz Ferdinand was assassinated Sarajevo, 1914, June 28th, I believe. And that's what started the First World War.
Right.
So the First World War, all the different alliances that were in Europe, Austria went to war against Serbia. Serbia was an ally of Russia. So Russia came in against Austria. Austria was allied with Germany. So all of that quickly produced the First World War. But the assassination of Franz Ferdinand meant that Charles, all of a sudden, you know, in 1914, he's 27 years old. He's only 3 years married. And he had a real military background. He had been on the front lines because, you know, he wasn't the actual heir at that stage. So he becomes emperor. He's 29 years old in 1916. So the war has been going on for 2.5 years. What people of our generation all just know that the war lasted 4 years. It was a great shock to Europe. They thought that this war of 1914, August, would just be a few weeks. It would clear up these kind of disputes. It would give some justice for the assassination of Franz Ferdinand, and it would be over. The fact that it lasted for 4 years and the carnage was immense, you know, they called it at the time the war to end all wars because they couldn't imagine anything worse. Of course, worse did follow. So by the time Charles became emperor, the war had been 2.5 years old, and he was a solitary and sometimes lonely voice for peace, and that's to his credit. What you have to understand a bit is that the people who had been there before, they were kind of locked in. They'd started this war. They didn't know how to get out of it. No one knew how to get out of it. Charles came in the middle of it. He wasn't there at the beginning, and by 2016, fall, they knew the war had to stop, and Austria was allied with Germany against Russia, which was allied with France, and the Americans were going to enter on the with allied power at size, we call it. And so therefore, Charles knew that he was not going to win the war. So it is to his credit, but there also were some just historical and tactical reasons why he was more inclined to call for peace. But there are two things. One, his own experience as a soldier on the front lines. He knew what the carnage of war was. And secondly, his deep Catholic faith. He realized that if you are an emperor, a king, you have to do everything in your power to protect the people you serve. And if there's a pointless war going on, you have to try and stop it.
So let's talk a little bit more about that relationship between the church and the state in the unique context of his empire and the different hats that he had to wear. I mean, my understanding is as the emperor in Hungary and, the emperor of Austria, the king of Hungary, the inheritor of what had previously been the Holy Roman Empire, there was either a de facto or a clear understanding that not only are you the head of state, the senior leader in the temporal sense, but you also had spiritual responsibilities as well. Is that correct? I mean, did he kind of wear two hats in that respect in terms of needing to attend to both the spiritual and the temporal welfare of his people?
Right. As I mentioned, your title, Crown and Crozier, sounds a bit like altar and throne. And when you think about crown and crozier today, you think, well, what is the relationship between this church and the state? What we call the altar and throne model, which goes way back into the Middle Ages, was that the church and the state were separate. That's one of the things that distinguishes Christian thinking, is that the state is not the church, that there are limits to Caesar and what Caesar can be granted. But the idea in the Middle Ages certainly was that the altar and throne, the church and the state, would work together. And therefore, the ruler, the civil ruler, the king, the duke, emperor, had the spiritual welfare of his people to look after. Even if he did not rule the church, he was to cooperate with it. Now, as you can imagine, this joint stewardship working for the common good occasionally worked very well, and more often than not led to disputes and conflicts. You know, it's one thing, you know, for us today to say, well, you know, the government has no authority here, and therefore we have to leave us alone. Well, if we actually said, well, the government does have some authority here, some, you know, something to offer us, then we start fighting about what exactly they should or shouldn't do, where the limits of it. And in Catholic history, we tend to look at what's called the investiture controversy. This goes back to the 11th century. If you're interested in church-state matters, this is one of the famous cases, Gregory the VII.
Sure. Who can appoint the bishops?
Exactly. Who has authority to appoint the bishops? So there's a conflict between altar and throne. As you move through that history, in the French Revolution, 1789, the revolution basically said is that the state is going to control everything. Interestingly, at that same time in the Habsburg Empire, there's a phase called Josephinism. The emperor at the time was named Joseph. And he basically said that I, as the emperor, will decide what is the spiritual good of this empire. And he famously said that contemplative monasteries were useless. They weren't doing anything productive, and so he dissolved them. So he had a high point there between this imperial ecclesial alliance where the emperor just said, I will rule everything, including the what we would call the liberties of the church. During the 19th century, this was worked out in many different European states, and under Franz Joseph, the long-serving emperor, there was, historically speaking, good relations. But throughout the 19th century, of course, the question was, should the church have any role in public life? By the time of Blessed Charles, who was only emperor, right, for 2 years, because he lost his empire, he died then 6 years after he became emperor, his personal piety was such that he would look for ways to support the church's life. And that would have been traditionally one of the roles of the king or the emperor, is, you know, to found monasteries, great shrines, to see to the spiritual welfare of the people. But where there's power, there's a temptation to misuse it. And you find that often in the history of the of these altar throne arrangements. And in fact, that term Josephinism from the 18th century is one kind of term we use for where the state subjects the church. It's very topical today because, as you know, with the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, the role of the Russian Orthodox Church, the Moscow Patriarchate, has come in for a very serious examination and criticism for its support of Vladimir Putin. And you may have heard these exotic terms like Caesaropapism, which is like, you know, that Caesar rules over the Pope or the Patriarch. But another term for that, not as well known, is Josephinism, and it comes from a period of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but it's about 120 years before Charles.
Among other things, it seems like one of the lessons from the legacy and the life of Blessed Karl is these tensions and these challenges between the church and the state. It seems like it's an enduring, recurring theme of history. Is it fair to say that it's inevitable? We're really going to see some kind of sweet spot cooperation or partnership. And on the flip side, is it fair to say that even looking at a place like Austro-Hungary and the Habsburg Empire, where you had people of deep faith and sincere piety like Charles, it was complicated and messy. So there's no such thing as the golden age, and we shouldn't have expectations of reliving or recapturing that golden age. Is that fair?
Fair enough to say. I mean, no time in history is perfect. And we see right from the beginning of, you know, in Exodus already, you know, you have at the end of Genesis, you have Joseph, the son of Jacob, in the Pharaoh's court, providing for the, you know, feeding the hungry nations. And by the time the book of Exodus opens, you know, the children of Israel are at odds with the Pharaoh. So it's been there all along. And in fact, you know, when Blessed Carl was promoting peace in 1917-18, one of the criticisms made of him is, well, Pope Benedict XV, who was Pope at the time, he had a peace, it was a peace proposal or a peace plan. And people say, well, yeah, but Charles is doing that because he's personally very devout. So he's being the Pope's errand boy, and he really shouldn't do that. He should be an emperor and do what's best for Austria and Hungary. He shouldn't be, you know, that was one of the criticisms. I'm not saying it's valid, but it was one of the criticisms that he was too religious. He should have been more focused on his civil duties, as it were. But yeah, there's always points of conflict. I would say that there are periods of history where you can say things are fairly good, you know, in our country, Canada. I know that your podcast takes up some of the points of contention now, but you could say that for a very long time, for Catholics who were never a majority in English Canada, of course, there were a majority in French Canada, you know, that they had well-respected religious liberty and able to contribute to the common good and so forth. And so you can find maybe not sweet spots, but sweet periods. I think what the lesson is that nothing is ever permanently fixed. And any arrangement that can be advantageous can become corrupted. One of the lessons of Carl's personal life is that even things that were considered very fixed, like the mighty centuries-long, enduring, solid Habsburg dynasty, even that wasn't fixed. And, you know, he lived to see the end of it. So that's a good lesson, I think, to take from his life, is that whatever arrangements we have are temporary.
So in that light, let's just say here in our backyard in Canada, I don't think it's any gross overstatement to say that there are a lot of apprehensions and concerns on the part of the faithful regarding the trajectory of our political culture. Here we have an example of Blessed Carl, a guy who showed that this model or this way of doing things is possible. We can get to yes. You can have a ruler who's also pious and faithful. As Canadians, as Catholics, in our day-to-day lives, what do you recommend in terms of doing justice and tribute to the legacy of a guy like Charles and trying to move our country, our native land, and our culture and our systems in a different direction?
The first thing I would say is that the value of knowing more of Blessed Carl is that he was actually the ruler who was faithful, because most of our heroes, when Catholics think about church-state relationships and they have heroes and saints, they usually think of people who were on the receiving end of wicked state power. So, you know, many people have a devotion to St. Thomas More in this field of public life. But St. Thomas More ended up imprisoned and executed. So we admire his courage. We admire the fact that he was at a very, very high level, basically the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and remained faithful. But he remained faithful by basically resigning his office, and then eventually he was martyred. We think of St. John Fisher in the same context. We think of Gregory VII, we mentioned. Well, Gregory VII, he won one battle, but he died in exile. So we tend to think of people who were on the receiving end. You know, we're recording this not far from the death anniversary of now St. Oscar Romero, a bishop who was killed by the government death squad. So we think of people who are on the receiving end. So when we think that way, our default is well, whoever holds power has got to be the wicked king. So it's just good for our balance to think that we do have holy kings, and they didn't belong just to the long ago period, you know, of St. Wenceslas and so forth like that. You know, there is something about that now. So I think for people who are in public life, they can be encouraged by example and pray for that. However, to answer your direct question, what practically can be done? We're moving into a period in which many forces are conspiring without any actual conspiracy, which would be easier because then you could identify the conspirators. But it's just there's many different circumstances working together to make the place of faith in our common life more difficult or to push it out or to exclude it. And I don't see any particular, you know, you can point to individual things that people are doing that are admirable. But it's certainly the case that now to live our faith, to live our Catholic faith, let alone heroically, just faithfully, we're feeling squeezed. And in that sense, Charles's life after the First World War, he wasn't squeezed out because of his Catholic faith, but, you know, he had to leave his country. He had to leave his throne. He went into exile. He lost a lot of his allies. He lost a lot of his even material wealth. And then he died quite early, leaving a widow and 8 children. His youngest child, I believe, was born after he died. So the hardship in life and exclusion and being driven out were the experiences of the last year of Charles's life. Now, you know, someone who finds it difficult to be a faithful Catholic because his family's against him or because her employer is difficult about that, that's not the same as losing the Austro-Hungarian throne, the dual monarchy. But there's something in Charles's life that gives us someone who maintained his peace and his devotion and his discipleship while he was literally being driven out. And so people who feel like they're being squeezed out have a good intercessor in that.
Just before we adjourn, I mean, you had mentioned previously the conflict between Russia and Ukraine and the Moscow Patriarch and relationship with President Putin. Obviously, it's a very live topic at the moment. And among the different angles of analysis for the situation that have come to the fore and a lot of media coverage, particularly in Catholic outlets, is this entanglement between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Russian presidency. And I think it's fair to say there's just a lot of confusion as it relates to that arrangement. Right. And what this invasion has brought to the fore is it's intriguing and somewhat disheartening to see where some people, including within the community of the faithful, are landing in terms of how they interpret this arrangement and maybe giving the benefit of the doubt to the patriarch or to President Putin as it relates to certain things. While, you know, isn't it good that the head of state is collaborating with the head of the church? On the opposite side, significant concern being expressed with statements made by the Moscow Patriarch in the aftermath of the invasion, essentially signaling approval or sanction, in the normative, the positive sense of the word, of Russia's actions. As final comment, your thoughts on that and guidance that you would offer in terms of making sense of that arrangement and whether and how it can be disentangled.
Yeah, well, what we're witnessing here is actually a massive scandal and wound in the church, because you do have a patriarch. Remember, in the history of the church, you know, Rome is Rome. Constantinople was thought to be the second Rome. And Moscow, when Constantinople diminished, and most Orthodox actually live in Russia, about half thinks of itself as a kind of a third Rome. So this is not an insignificant, you know, peripheral bishop. He's one of the most important figures in Christianity. So this is a big wound. And it actually is a real scandal. The sexual abuse scandals, we use that term, were scandals in the sense of people behaved in an appalling way, but they didn't necessarily encourage other people to behave. Very few people looked at that and said, oh, I should follow that. Scandal is actually, in this very technical sense, right, means you do something that's bad and actually encourages other people to do bad things. And, you know, the sexual abuse scandal wasn't like that. It didn't encourage people, I don't think, to, you know, want to imitate that. But this is a real scandal that many people who like the fact that Putin has built churches and that, you know, he has a very prominent role for the patriarch, it's actually leading them astray. So what people who are not familiar with the history of the Russian Orthodox Church need to know a few things. So they come to a good judgment or an accurate judgment, but not an overly, you know, I want to say harsh one, although it is in itself kind of harsh situation. So the Russian Orthodox Church has long had a relationship with whoever is running Russia. In that sense, not entirely different than what was going on in Austria. And, you know, the Archbishop of Vienna always had a relationship with the Habsburg Emperor, and most often the Pope had a relationship. That was the norm in Russia for a long time. So this question of balance and excess one way or the other was part of the same long story that you find in other parts of Europe. After the Bolshevik Revolution and the coming of communism, 1917, Lenin and then Stalin unleashed a ferocious persecution. So the Russian Orthodox Church has tens of thousands of martyrs. I think tens of thousands of priest martyrs. By 1941, I think they were down to three bishops instead of several hundred bishops.
Wow.
They were almost eliminated with this fearsome persecution. And then 1941, the Allies, Stalin's Russia, Soviet Union, and Hitler's Germany turn on each other. Hitler invades, Soviet Union invades Russia. Stalin realizes that he is in the fight for his life. The Soviet Union, which includes Ukraine at that time, lost 20 million people in the Second World War. It paid the highest price. Stalin said, the only way I can rally the whole country to save itself against the German invasion is a great patriotic struggle, he called it. And so Stalin in 1941 reconstitutes the Russian Orthodox Church. But he reconstitutes it on his terms, right? This was not religious liberty. This was the church now being called to rally the people to the side of the Red Army, being patriotic, trying to renew some of that Russian pride. And so from 1941 right up to 1991, when the Soviet Union was dissolved, the Russian Orthodox Church and all of its leadership, you couldn't be a leader in that church unless you were already collaborating with the state. So you have to understand that, is that the Russian Orthodox Church, which a very proud and profoundly important spiritual patrimony, from 1941 to 1991 was operated as a kind of a branch of the state by the state's choice, not its own choice. We're now 30 years past that, but you know, 30 years in the life of a church, 30 years in the life of a patriarch is not that long.
Sure.
So Kirill came up through that model. And the big challenge for the Russian Orthodox Church after communism was to try and purify itself from all these state entanglements and to become a real church as opposed to an arm of the state. However, that means giving up some of your privileges, giving up some of your status. Because after 1991, one way for Russia under Yeltsin and then under Putin to say we're not in the bad old communist period was to lavish resources on the church. We're rebuilding this cathedral. We're building that cathedral. And many people whom you mentioned, when they look from abroad, from a distance, and say, well, look at that. You know, in our country, we're being hemmed in by our government. And here's someone who's actually building churches. So that's why people, I think, may have been attracted to that. That being said, what we actually see there is what in that old term, Caesaropapism, is that Caesar and the Pope, in this case, the President and the Patriarch, work by the Patriarch being subservient. So that's the history there. And Kirill himself is a personally compromised. He'd spent time in the secret state apparatus. Look, what he should have done, you know, 13 years ago when he became patriarch, and what he should have done in the last few weeks would have required of him tremendous courage. And we might legitimately criticize what he's done because it is scandalous. But it's also possible if he hadn't done it, he would not be alive today. Putin doesn't tolerate dissidents. So it's true, you know, when we look back on, you know, under the time of Henry VIII, we say they should have done, right? Only a few of them actually did it, and we remember their names. So that's what's going on, is that we have a bishop, a patriarch, who is under enormous pressure from the emperor, you know, or the president, the czar, and he's become complicit. And it will be for us a kind of a shock and a wound to see a Christian bishop do that, Orthodox bishop. But this will be a crisis for the Russian Orthodox faithful. Hopefully a crisis that will allow after this, as it loses the almost the entire credibility, that whatever credibility it had, to rebuild itself and to purify itself. But it's possible it could just be a blow from which they don't recover it. So it's a very serious and grave situation.
Well, among the intentions we add to our list at the moment then is praying for a new season, a new breath of life, a season of renewal in the Church of our brethren in Russia.
Certainly, yes, certainly. And by the way, the other Orthodox patriarchs, including the one in Constantinople, the Ecumenical Patriarch, and other patriarchs, including the Moscow-aligned patriarch in Ukraine, they themselves have said what Moscow has done is unacceptable. So this wound and this division is being felt very intensely in the world of Orthodoxy.
We can entrust our intentions to Blessed Karl of Austria, right, and hope that he can intercede on behalf of our brethren there and intercede for the sake of peace in Ukraine and for all the places in the world that are experiencing conflict, whether it's Yemen, Ethiopia, Afghanistan, and intercede in the ongoing spiritual warfare, which we encounter in our part of the world here in the West. And trusting in the word of the Lord, as he said, that blessed are the peacemakers. And it's been a wonderful session with you, exploring that lesson, the blessedness of the peacemakers, looking at it through the life and legacy of Karl of Austria. Really appreciate your insights and time today, Father Raymond. Thanks again for being here with us.
Very good. Thank you, Patrick, and God bless your good work. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. And help us to reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. If you'd like to partner with us in the delivery of this podcast, head on over to our website at crownandcrozier.com and click the heart button in the top right-hand corner to learn more about making a one-time or monthly donation. We're sincerely grateful for you listening in, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship. Until then, God bless.